We have four of the poets here today, a fifth poet on video, and a sixth poet not here today, but some of you may have heard him, Richard Osmond, at the launch of the festival last Friday. So the poets are Rachel Allen, Isabel Gallimore, Daisy Lafarge, Richard O'Brien, Richard Osmond, and Mark Payak, or Pajak, we don't know how his name is pronounced. The first poet who's going to read is going to be Mark Payak, who's going to be on a video because he's in the north of Scotland, so couldn't get down here from there in the time and back again. He was born on Merseyside, studied creative writing at Liverpool John Moores University and Manchester Metropolitan University. He won the 2016 Bridport Prize and received a Northern Writers Award from New Writing North in 2016. And he also took up the 2016 Apprentice Poet in Residence Ilkley Literature Festival. His first pamphlet, Spitting Distance, was selected as a laureate's choice and is published with Smith Doorstop. And one of the judges, Imtiaz Darker, referred to his work as language coiled tight to spring open with precisely calculated force. So would you now welcome Mark Payak from Ullapool in Scotland.
I'm going to read three poems for you, and this first one is called Brood. It was written for and begins with a quote from John Berger, and in their glance was permanence. At 16, I did a day's work on an egg farm, a tin shed the size of a hangar. Inside its oven dark, 2,000 stacked cages, engines of clatter and squawk. My job, to pass a torch through the bars for the dead hens and pack them tight into a bin bag. All the time my mind chanting, there's only one hen. Just one ruined hen, repeated over and over. In this way, I soothe the sight of all that caged battery, their feathers stripped to stems, their patches of scrotum skin, their bodies held in the dead hands of their wings. But what kept me awake that hot night in my box room as I listened to the brook outside chew on its stones and the fox's human scream was how those thousand birds had watched me. And really, it was me. Repeated over and over, set in the amber of their eyes. Me, the frightened boy, in jeans stiff with chicken shit, carrying a bin bag full of small movement. A foot that opened, an eye that unshelled its blind nut. A beak mouthing a word. This second poem is called Spitting Distance, and it's the title piece of my pamphlet. Near Edale, I find a live rifle shell. Like a gold seed in the earth. So I load it into my mouth and go on walking. The sun breathing down my neck, the head of Mamtor rising and the path falling like a braid. So this is what it's like to be a gun, copper bleeding on the gums. The domino click in the teeth. At the blue summit, I look down with my new perspective on the warped floor of Derbyshire, to where a village pools in a valley, and a chimney hangs from the sky on a white string. And I watch with hunger the red dot of a car stop at a crossroads. I suck hard on the blunt bud, drawing out its deeper flavour of powder, smoke down the barrel of my throat. And then it hits me that there's another side to this. And I lay in the warm heather, a body with a bullet in its head, staring at this sky, its clouds blown open, its sudden night. And finally, I'm going to read a newer poem that doesn't appear in my pamphlet, and it's called Crystal. Just one word I need to gloss is a word called thistle. It's a Scots word and it means soft hiss. Last orders. I put my cloth to a misty wine glass and twist the shine in like a light bulb. At the end of my bar, a girl, maybe 20, her turned back, her pint, and a man's hand spilling a powder, a fissile from an envelope like a slow fuse. Her lager's fine chains of fizz suddenly shake until all the liquid is the white tail of a rattlesnake. But it's late. I can't be certain. I hold up the wine glass, fill it with the bar's dirty light, hang it on the rack where it slides to snap against the bowl of another. That chime, the sound of glass almost breaking. I slowly twist and hang, twist and hang with such crystal concentration. I nearly don't notice when she finally stands to leave. Her spine wags and is steadied by a man's hand. The last wine glass is hung. Upside down, they are a line of bells without tongues. Clear now. When she turns her face against his shoulder, she is younger than 18. They leave behind her pint glass, a last drag, a spray of white, asking to be washed and polished and held up to the light.
Aren't you all glad we managed to get him on video? Yes. Tremendous. The next poet is Rachel Allen. Her poetry has recently appeared in Poetry London, Poetry, the American Poetry in Chicago, Ambit and Leaf. She studied English literature at Goldsmiths University and is completing a PhD at Hull University. Her first collection is forthcoming from Faber in 2019. She's also published a pamphlet in the Faber New Poets series. She's the poetry editor of Granta, co-editor at the Poetry Press Clinic, and of the online journal Tender. And one of the judges, Aaron Warner, said of her work, "A collection of poems that is at ease with its own brilliance and fuses an absolutely ambitious poetic voice with a serious engagement with the contemporary world." You please welcome Rachel Allen.
Thanks, Neil. And thank you for having us here at the festival. I'm going to start with a quote from a horror writer called Thomas Ligotti that I feel sort of, well, I've appropriated to act as an introduction to some of my poems. The only value of this world lay in its power at certain times to suggest another world. This poem starts with an epigraph from Federico Garcia Lorca. Kingdom Land. At the rise of the moon, bells fade out and impassable paths appear. The dark village sits on the crooked hill. There is a plot of impassable paths towards it. Impassable paths overcome with bees, the stigma that bees bring. There is a bottleneck at the base of the hive. There is an impassable knowledge that your eyebrows bring. Beside the poor library and the wicker man, there's a man who sells peacock feathers on the roundabout. They scream all night from where they are plucked. The village is slanted, full of tragedies with slate. I am walking towards a level crossing, while someone I love is jogging into the darkness. Come away from there, I am yelling, while the black dog rolls in the twilight yard. Small white socks bob into the dark, like teeth in the mouth of a laughing man who walks backwards into night, throwing drinks into the air like a superstitious wife throws salt. We all have our share of certainties. The glass and salt, my petulant daughter. The glass and salt, my crooked pathway. Impassable glass and salt. Prawns of Joe. This poem's after Salima Hill. When I had a husband, I found it hard to breathe. I was up early, he'd get home late to rub the baby. We took it in turns. He left, and if someone knocked for him now at the door, I would not let him go to them. In amongst all the crying, I see a burning child on the stove, the same one as before. The curtains are full of soot. Well, quickly, we need to escape. Well, surely, no, I watch her burn. What is it I love about the sound of dogs barking as smoke rises out the window? What a complete noise, like a pile of hands clapping. Another body found burned in the oval, purple and mystical, and all around her, peppery crisps in the shape of a heart. There's a woman over the road who moved in when he left. She has a black little finger and has been watching me for days. Her shadow is that of a man's in the right light. Sometimes she's right outside the window. Sometimes I think she's in the house, in the cupboard, under the sink, or behind the shower curtain. I hold her name like grit between my teeth, turning cartwheels by the edge of the stream. The air is touchy. Fiberglass, summer streams through the trees like a long blonde hair. I want to grab all the things that make me ashamed and throw them from the bridge, like how I don't like the sun at the end of the day, eating cold cream cakes on the dimming porch in the yellow breeze, lonely, just thinking up these stories. So I fling my fork into the bark like a stroppy dictator. It makes that cartoon stuck in wood noise. I am stuck in the middle of the month again. I would like some time on my hands, something like a stain. Happy birthday floats up to my window, followed by your name, your purple name. Black pennies with cow faces down a black well. You stood no chance of being born, I tell myself, as the sea cannibalizes. It manages to forgive itself every day without visions of the baby wizened, making her way towards me, crawling slowly across the indigo field. I was glad to hear a poem that's touched on vegan themes by Mark Pajak, because I often think about the position of animals in our society and the sort of contradiction inherent in having a pet cat and eating a pig or a cow. And I've written a few poems on this. The first one takes its inspiration from Tadukken, which is a sort of American imported monstrosity that's like a bird inside of a bird inside of a bird inside of a bird. Many bird roast. I came in, dandy and present, arguing for a moratorium on meat of the kind splayed out on the table, legs akimbo like a fallen over ice skater skidding on her backside. There are dogs in the outhouse and all over the world that we do not eat, and one small sparrow in a pigeon, in a grouse, in a swan that we will certainly eat, overlooking all the drama, with as many eyes as a spider that will cut into, and the compacted layers of the various meats will fall away dreamily as a rainbow melts down into the marsh where it came from. Slipping meat from the bone onto a specially designed knife, there's a call out for plates. I'm the only one with a sense of outcry. Someone says, you weren't like this when it was broiling away, smelling like your history, smelling like the deep skin on your knee after playing in the sun all day, skinned with good dirt and your underblood just showing through, smelling like warm, dry furs after burning and the outdoors after fireworks and November's after tea. You eat and smell like the rest of us, dirty rat under your armpit, dirty bird in your stomach. And birds fell down through the chimney with thwacks into buckets, and we got so poor we had to eat them too, strange cockatoos and once a brilliantly lit, pure white dove that we kept in a hutch with a small pot of ink, and when we let it out, it wasn't so much a raven as just a plain black dove, ready to cook, and with superstition I learnt to. And I'll just finish with two poems, a meaty one and a not meaty one. Beef cubes. Hot, tight penny, that girl at school who put talc on her face and sausage blush on her cheeks was a meat clown. Terry felt through her jean shorts, told everyone she was wet. Push him off your lap, we told her. Thong showing, brown squares in the pastry bin as she'd been sick. She was incredibly thin and kept getting thinner, like when you turn a kind of mirror till you're flat. Muscle memory from her panic attacks kept her off the beach, where the whale cut in half parades its yellow fat, and the tourists come, stroked and swollen, on its back, like you, hot, tight penny, its fins a hot pocket, people milling as the sun sets, laying down blankets, one beef patty turning on the grill by the large blue carcass, by the large blue sea. Prairie burning. There is a man who circles the perimeter with a baby in his arms, unmoving. Locusts burn with the silhouettes of saints at dusk. Saints are in the cloud. We are in a dry storm. The man extends his circles, pulling the baby through the cactus scrub. Look at his melting trainers in the heat. They aren't what he asked for. There are black leather skids on the dry stone wall. People in black cloaks run out of the corner of your eye. A pig turns on a spit. The prairie is a terrarium for the blaze, but the edge is dry of fire. It is the height of one season. Bushes burn. A burnt five-year-old without eyelids turns quick cartwheels through the heat wave under the big pale sky, black and blue. Thank you.
After that visceral beginning of the reading, I think we may have a bit of a shift now to Isabel Gallimore. Carol Rumens said of her work, the poems reach out to a broader engagement with the macrocosm. I find them technically excellent, original, and imaginative. Carol Rumens was one of the other judges of this year's Gregory Award. Isabel's debut pamphlet, Dazzleship, was published by Warple Press in 2014. Her poems have been featured in Poetry, Poetry London, and Poetry Review. After completing a PhD in eco-poetry and metaphor at the University of Exeter, she became the Charles Causley Poet in Residence. Later in 2016, she travelled to the Peruvian Amazon for a poetry residence at the Tambopata Research Centre, and she's currently working on her first full collection. Would you please welcome Isabel Gallimore?
It's lovely, really lovely to be here. As Rachel said, thank you for having us. I have a few very short poems to read. The first is called Eye and Sight. When I was a stay-at-home eye, sight would often leave me. Like water lifting from a lake, he mixed with other bodies. I guessed he loved the way clouds love, the free and godly view, and didn't know the more he pledged himself to this pursuit, the more he'd rain back to me. Like any eye, I sank all his disclosures through a nerve that streamed towards the dark. Often think if I have a totem animal, then the totem animal I have is the limpet, which is kind of peculiar, well, partly because it's a limpet, but also because I move around a lot and I'm certainly not stuck in one place. This poem is about the whelk that feeds on the limpet. It's called The Limpet and the Drill-Tongued Whelk. Across the rock pool floor, a limpet grazes. A stray magician's cup, moon-textured, the shape of light pointing through frosted glass. It is a modest party hat in which something like a head resides, oblivious of this dog whelk that pads against the thick, still brine and climbs upon the limpet, an ornate seat upon an elephant. Carnivorous mollusk, tiny fracking rig, clocking in with its drill tongue, clutching as the limpet rises from the stone to become half mushroom, half bucking bronco. The next poem is about barnacles, another favourite of mine. Darwin was perhaps one of the first people to point out that relative to its body size, the barnacle has the largest penis in the animal kingdom. Apparently it can stretch up to 8 times its own body length, and this poem is kind of broadly about that. It's called The Barnacles. It's probably a bit early in the day for this kind of thing, I think. Okay. Think of them now, invincible, endeavour, well endowed with this swamping thatch of teeth, this citadel of calciferic bedsits their single occupants can never leave. What is it about November that washes urge into this one's sinus heart, eliciting his wily pipette that with its several accordion folds stretches beyond his stuck-fast self to become a proboscis, a blind man's stick, a bristle with sniffing as it wavers and knocks against his lady neighbour's operculum doors, only to break off like part of the rigging when the mood no longer takes him. Okay. this poem is from my pamphlet called Dazzleship. Notes on Death as the Other Woman. Sue takes the musical score from his desk. He's serving 4 months on a dazzleship. The sun trips into the mirror, and by the light of this small explosion, she finds its cover holds the ghost of his last note. Fragments move as if he's still writing. Certain scrawled words become Chinese whispers. Dear death, the life I leave. Under that black dress, I sucked your breasts. The score drops the length of Sue's floral pinafore. She takes the bin out. Castor and Pollux are lit in the sky. There's a man up the road, but she can't say whether he's walking towards her or walking away. So, moving away from the sea, as Neil said, I spent some time in the Amazon jungle last November, and it made me think again about limpets and barnacles and various species we have on Earth, and to think about the number of species that we have on Earth and also the rate of extinction. This poem is called Choosing. Choosing from 8 million differently constructed hearts. I couldn't. I chose to love them all. The squid's triptych of pumps, the snake's cardial sac, growing as it eats. To say nothing will come between us, to stay benignly intimate was Sometimes not calling was easier. Sometimes I'd forget to touch you, and you, and you. A natural phenomenon dwindling, one of a dozen breakups from the world each day. Like the others, it seemed you just popped out for a pint of milk, and now nothing's conjured hearing your name. The Amazon was very disorienting. It was probably as threatening as I expected it to be walking through it each day. But I found a really kind of rich metaphorical quality to the names of the species that I was encountering. A lot of the insects, a lot of the bats. And in this poem, I've kind of tried to convey some of that dizzying sense by losing the literal animals and keeping their names. It's called The New World. Its leaf nose a clock, the pink toes are poised. In the dark understory, a wolf with eight legs dines on the harlequin's long eyes. A whip on the floor, a whip on the limb, the bushmaster waits. An untouchable lobster fattens upon the leaf litter. Somebody is calling for mother, mother. Somebody munches on sphinx. For all their splashing in the figaries, the earless family can't wake the kitty sounds from sleep. And just to finish with another poem from the Amazon, this is called Trapline. Trapline is often the phrase that's used for the roots that hummingbirds will remember to find food in. And that kind of features in this poem. Trapline. When the real and painted eyes are upon me, when the erotic palms jumble of droops is stationed at such frequency, I've not known where to look. As if I were one of the many flowers the hermit traps and tongues, I can't stop the air indulging in me. I walk with great anxiety. At night, wings unbutton to hairy chests. Poison choruses or stiffens. I'm told the more I let myself be touched, the less I will be bitten. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Our next poet is Daisy Lafarge, who is currently completing her PhD at the University of Glasgow. Her first pamphlet, Understudies for Air, will be published by Sad Press in August. Her works appeared in Poetry London, The White Review, the anthology Best British Poetry 2015, and the upcoming Poetry Review. In February 2016, she was awarded first prize in the Poetry Book Society National Student Poetry Competition. And Imtiaz Darker said of her work that it's unafraid of risks, taking on an uncompromising stand against the lyric and the unexpected. Please welcome Daisy Lafarge.
Thank you all for coming. The poem I'm going to begin with begins with a quote from Albert Einstein in response to his research being used to develop atomic weapons. And he said, "If I had known, I should have become a watchmaker." The horologist's lunch. It is perhaps unsurprising that the horologist's lunch was never on time. It could even be so that the tardiness of his cheddar and cut crust sandwich was a prime mover in his temporal infatuation, that within a half-hour window his wife would emerge in the door of his study, flushed with a sickle of jam on her cheek and excuses like the baby or washing. And he would frown as the room reprimanded her with its corollary of ticking, and she retreated outside to the afternoons she knew were longer than the years, although she dared not admit it. "Look, this'll help," he said, pushing a small cold thing into her hand. It was white gold, no bigger than a chestnut. There were all the months and minutes, calmly orbiting a white, irreproachable face. "Dear God, it's just like him," she thought, as he smiled back correctly, his teeth forming an orderly queue. Her face was nothing like a clock. She quietly repulsed him. They could neither understand why the gift made her dizzy. At dinner, he would mock her in front of guests. "Excuse my wife, she can't even tell the time." As she quietly wondered what could be told to time that it didn't already know. But she did know her husband's secret. As she stood at the edge of the high summer field, her mind ticking on with the invisible click of insects, watching the stillness of their rustling swarm in which no hands moved at all. The secret being that really her husband's clocks didn't need to tick, that in fact their parts could glide in unsnagged silence, and that maybe even he didn't know it, but the ticking was the closest he got to another being's pulse, that the percussion of his study drummed over his solitude, the persistent echolalia of his clockwork self. The next two poems feature a character called Jeannie. What Jeannie got. She got it in the chest like the thump of Elijah. Awoke one morning to the trumpet of her mother, its mouthpiece fused to the notch above her sternum. All Jeannie knew was that she woke up for school and saw the duvet rising sharply between her breasts, its worn-out cotton an ascending minaret that tugged itself back in reverence, declaring the terrible instrument in matrilineal splendour. Jeannie didn't touch or caress its tubulation to try and still its cries, but as she breathed out slowly, the trumpet started yelling, so that cracks began to scale the walls, each one spawning derivatives as she fought with the trumpet for air. Jeannie held her breath, and the artex started raining. The year processed in discord. Jeannie became adept at the opposite of breathing and made very little sound at all. But her mother's orchestra had other plans. Her gangs of woodwind would heckle from buildings through menacing throats of gargoyles, while brassy-eyed buttons of anonymous instruments winked like fish skins from hedges. They always seemed to meet her at the importunest of moments. On Saturdays spent working at hotel wedding functions, when the sudden exhalation of an untuned celesta might shatter her tray of champagne flutes. Or the time she tried to kiss Serena behind the privacy of her locker, only to find it filled with symbols, stacked like dry stone, making horizontal purdas of the sweetly staling air. It was only the one symbol that slipped out of line, but Serena backed away, unravelled by its timbre. Jeannie was left in the reverberant air, breathing in the lustful geometry of lockers, the plasterboard walls of discoloured posters and fading acne of blue tack, the fluids that flaked off sticky-backed textbooks, particles from the prefabs that rose in wet fields and found their way to her through commutes of corridors, which offered themselves as half-bleached sacraments, which Jeannie took in wholly. And the ravens brought her bread and flesh in the evening and bread and flesh in the morning, and she drank of the brook. Stag night in the embassy with Jeannie. And when the men woke up on the wrong side of history, it was an unfamiliar feeling they at first mistook for a hangover. In the sick morning light of a breakfast bar, of a chain hotel, of average and ubiquitous luxury, contemplating their actions of the night before, nudging underbaked knobs of almond croissants with incremental crumbs of mirth. What none of them could recall was how they'd ended the night in the embassy's basement, inside a crate of flags where they'd woken whimpering, top and tail, that morning. The flags had seemed plain enough the night before, but now each of the men's cheeks were creased with the nondescript weft of nylon, whose symbols of unknown nations showed no signs of fading with time. The faces of the men bore puffy, sheepish witness to a commonwealth of newfound loyalties, formed in the overnight scapes of neutrality with slow and steady aqueous agencies, by Jeannie who had lured them to the crate in the first place, which is also a front for the club she ran called Limbo. "What we need is a story," they murmur, passing a small pot of jam between them. The men continue to murmur and pass the jam, the jar becoming thinner and thinner as their hands wear away the glass that turns back into sand, which the men continue to pass as tight fistfuls of land, which also slip through their fingers and make filigree around their feet that stack into deposits, that grow into columns of increasing precarity and tower above the men, who fail to look up as the towers collapse and bresciate their lungs, which comes to be known as the rapture of alluvium. Anywhere except trees. Could scarcely tell you what they were doing, the trees. Half passed out down riparian banks, their roots rucked up and poised to the sun. If a forest could be hung over, it would look like this. The trunks half-dressed and feigning their own shadows, leering unsteadily at the river's morning lips. I was busy walking backwards, clearing the stream from the mulch of our talk, peeling off promises snagged onto branches. Like Gretel in reverse, the task came easily. I gleaned the dirt path from our latent fling harvest, while little bulbs of brevity went singing in my pocket. By the time I was done, it was as though we'd never walked there. As if you'd never mentioned the dormant hollowness of everything, how it is most infectious in peacetime and grows in conditions of perceived stability like mutiny, or how a smile is just skin pulled taut that will one day crack and be forced to reveal its more wound than disposition. Or maybe I'd tell it better if we were sat across the formica table of an American diner, stirring our drinks and reclining in the sex red of a wipe clean booth. I'd grab a handful of straws to indicate the roots, putting them all in my mouth at once and sucking the cornstarch air, saying, the real way to make decisions is to toss a coin and measure your degree of disappointment, thus pitting melon-heavy reason against a co-conspiring gut. Then I'd drop the straws to sink into something glutinous, and we'd look outside to where we'd parked the Chevy, whose colour we'd recognise instantly, and beyond that to the horizon, lapped by the road flapping fat and dry as a dog's hot tongue, a width that always astounds me, the horizon going anywhere except trees. And I'm going to finish with a very short poem called Throttle Song. She wants to be more like moonlight, or a sky filled with porcelain, as it cracks under skittish weight and bleeds the rosy milk of planets. She wants the old song with dirty words and dirty old sung hands that orbit her throat as she barks red and white at the sky. Does she? Thanks very much.
Thank you, Daisy. And our fourth poet here to read will be Richard O'Brien, who studied English and French at Oxford University and an MA in Shakespeare creativity. He's now working on a PhD on Shakespeare and the development of verse drama at Birmingham. He's the author of 3 poetry pamphlets and has twice been a winner of the Foyle Young Poets of the Year Award. He also won the London Book Fair Poetry Prize in 2015, and he's commissioning editor of the Emma Press and writes and translates poetry for children. And one of the judges, Carol Rimmons, said, the author is always beautifully equal to the occasion in terms of syntactical variety, rhythm, pitch, and tone, an eye for intricate detail and a gift for storytelling. Will you please welcome Richard O'Brien?
Thank you, Neil, and to Eka, everyone else, thank you so much for having us, and it was wonderful to hear all of your work as well. Discipline. Some find it in the ticking of a clock, each day articulated joint by joint. Some in a boat manoeuvred through a lock with a precision close to needlepoint, or in box zero. There are certain schools which hold we're at our best held to account, that each gram filched in wriggling from the rules weighs on the mind at double the amount. I understand, though lax and slug abed at times, the pleasure of a pointillist whose thousandth bead of paint completes one red sunstreak, whose effort, concretizing mist, requires hours of dregs and low-drawn blinds. Some find it. There are others whom it finds. And Daisy's poem just mentioned a dodgy booth, so I'm going to mention some more booths in this poem. This is about one of my favourite TV characters, Roger Sterling from Mad Men, who I'm not sure if how many of you have seen it, but is a sort of very elegant, charming, dapper man, but also a really terrible person who just kind of blunders through his life in this kind of cloud of privileged arrogance, sort of destroying everything he touches. So this is New York Deluxe. What would it be to float, unburdened through by your ignorance, through life as through a bar which serves, tuxedoed to your private booth, a cocktail where the sparkling salt encrusts the rim, the old world grafted on the new, and yet, as you dab from your lips the froth of half a century, the remnants of an empire's long lunch, the skyscrapers which stud the sky like trophies on a mantelpiece, seem to be saying, when you die, silk-gowned in the Astoria, that all the bellboys north of 50th will mourn for you. The candles dimmed at Sardi's will invite you to another round of chintz and succulents, your hair a mess like only hair like yours can be, the lobster always fresh and never finished, with your napkin tossed across its shattered back, red like the cracked red leather seat from which you spill to toast and scatter jokes to anyone who's listening, who won't forget your banjo duet. Swirl a digestif, let someone else collect the check, and step into the cold night and your double-breasted coat. Go sliding through the pavement snow, all power, all brutality, distilled to a highball glass with a maraschino cherry on the top. This is a poem which was in the Emma Press anthology of Fatherhood, and it's called Among the Doctors. It's inspired by the Bible story when Jesus goes and preaches at the temple for a few days, and his parents are like, you could have told us. Among the doctors. You always were a dreadful carpenter, the world in your hands and all thumbs, son. I soon stopped asking you to stand across from me and turn a two-man lathe. I almost lost a finger to your thoughts of higher things. You had your father's eyes, which is to say, not mine, the day you said you went about your business, which is to say, not mine. 3 days we searched, tearing up every splinter of the town, before we saw you through that gilded grate. Your mother sent me in, as if to call you in to dinner from those learned men. I'd never seen such green and gold. I heard it in the words you used, a kind of sawdust gumming up my tongue. You were 12 then. They doubted you belonged to me. It was the first time I had let you go. This time, we're shaking hands. Your cotton glove, the calloused paw half shaking in my apron. Go, be who you are. Tell everyone you meet who makes the finest table legs in Galilee. Put down your tools. Remember me. Okay, I'm going to read two poems which are from a sort of sequence about a scientific experiment in 1965 where a scientist called John Lilly was interested in whether dolphins could learn human language for a variety of reasons, which perhaps there isn't time to go into here. But To facilitate this, a woman called Margaret Howe ended up living for 6 weeks in a flooded apartment in the Virgin Islands with a bottlenose dolphin called Peter, trying to teach him to speak, and it didn't work. Margaret's visitor. The doorbell never rings. I still anticipate the TV sitcom Bait and Switch, the postboy's shock as Peter concertinas through the water to the door and nabs the letter in his mouth, rotates the handle with his bottle nose and nabs the letter in his mouth, delivering a suave Midwestern thanks. And I descend, still fresh from 6 weeks in a lurex bathing suit, to wait for his reply. I see the postboy see the desk that hovers with its laminated paperwork like the chrome cloud of an indifferent god. The hair I shave to bring us closer tufting out, my black lips like a faded mime. And I see Peter, halfway human now, his eyes above the water, sitting on his nose, easy as spectacles. Oh, no, he says. It's no trouble at all, craning to sign, the pen between his teeth. I'm by his side, a painting of two homesteaders leaning on leaf nets as if they were farming tools. A ball bobs in the background, childishly, but we have put such things away. I ask him where he'd like our new delivery. We watch the pool boy stagger, fish-legged, down the street, his mouth a gasping blowhole. This is another one in that sequence called 4th of July, which I thought was appropriate for this week. Of course he wouldn't wear a hat. Of course the soggy ticker tape. Of course this can of frosting in the dark. Waterlight softening its jagged edges. And for just a tick, I seriously thought, what if I slit his throat? The body bundled in the elevator. Blood spreading like a firework, like neurons forming point by point until it reached the grouting. Those men in caps, the dries I called them, laughing as they slapped it on the walls, asking which one of us had chosen this shade of paint, me or the herring hog. Nothing from John. I turned the setup, watched him yawp, my country, tis of thee. My saturated bed, a second mermaid puberty. His jealous shrieks when my mother phoned. You can always come home. I gave my lesson. I wrung out the flag. 5 weeks and he can't count to three. Some holiday. I spent it scrubbing algae from the walls. A bad joke and a spangled leotard as Peter threw himself against the barriers of language, battering my legs with a persistence that was almost human. I think I'll just read one more. This is a poem called Hammam. His potbelly and towel, a business dress. I'm dunked and drenched in a warm and soothing rain. First, I'm pulled down with a torturer's finesse, head to my knees, then thrust to the wall again. Then, with a bristly glove and a firm caress, he scrubs my body like a stubborn stain. Each in his alcove, moulded and scraped by ritual, purrs at the loosening grip of the habitual. He strafes me with suds. He rubs me down like a dog. His little finger deftly probes my ear. He, motherly, rinses my hair. My pores unclog a bead curtain of sweat, and as it clears, though I can't mute my inner monologue, it joins the slow drip in the background. Here, under the clean white dome which Sinan plotted, I come to see how some can sleep unknotted. After, we loll in robes, sip lemonade, prepare to shoulder on the social shells left in our lockers. From that purchased shade, we'll join the crowded streets of Istanbul, buy baklava and fight about free trade. I thank, afraid to feel imperial, the man I paid to take away my dirt. I tie my shoes. I button up my shirt. Thank you.